Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's webinar call. Today, October 19th, we discuss China fully engaged in Latin America. What is the U.S. plan? My name is Guy DeSanctis, and I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Today, we are fortunate to have with us our moderator, Julian Koo, Maurice A. Dean, Distinguished Professor of Constitutional Law at Hofstra University in New York. Throughout the panel, if you have any questions, please submit them to the question and answer feature so that our speakers will have access to them for when we get to that portion of the webinar. With that, thank you for being with us today. Julian, the floor is yours.
Great. Thank you so much. Thanks for everyone for joining us on this call. So I want to first thank Karen Lugo, who is the who brought this idea to fruition and then dragged all of us together and put everything together. And we're just here to implement her plan. So thank you so much, Karen, for putting this idea together. And I think it's a really important discussion. There's really two questions, I think, that just for an average FedSoc member to think about that are in the news, but maybe you don't really understand, like I don't always understand as well as I should. First is China's Belt and Road Initiative. You hear a lot about this, but you know, it's what exactly it is a little bit murky sometimes. And then I think another thing that we don't talk enough about is what is the actual concrete impact, especially on places we care a lot about, like our neighbors in the South and Latin America. So this conversation, I hope, will illuminate in a more concrete way what exactly how the U.S.-China strategic competition that we hear a lot about is manifesting itself outside just the realms of, say, military competition. And arguably, this economic competition in places like Southeast Asia or Latin America are just as important to this U.S.-China competition as the military question. So this is a great way for us to investigate this. And so I'm delighted to introduce to have three panelists today, all of whom have really terrific insights and knowledge on these questions in different ways. So we'll hear, I'll briefly introduce them here, but they both have very long, all three of them have very long, interesting backgrounds, but we have Google, you can find out more about them. But just to briefly describe them, we have Dr. Evan Ellis, a research professor of Latin American Studies at the U.S. Army War College Strategic Studies Institute, who also previously served at the State Department's policy planning staff related to Latin America and the Caribbean. We'll also hear from Dr. Ryan Berg, a senior fellow in the Americas program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, whose research also focuses on U.S. Latin America relations. And that's includes a lot of stuff I'm not going to mention, so it's too much to go through here, but pretty much everything, actually. So he'll be a great resource for us. And then finally, we'll hear from Mr. Eric Bremen, CEO and Chairman of the Board at Honduras Prospera. Previous to his current career as a cool entrepreneur, Eric had a long career in investment banking and finance, and he had some really great insights about some on-the-ground views of what the things that are going on in Central America and Latin America with respect to BRA and other things. So I do encourage all of you, you know, that these are all tremendous experts for us, and thank you so much for joining us. So I'm going to just take 3 minutes, hopefully, to set the table by explaining to our audience what BRI is, and then I'll turn it over to our experts to discuss the U.S. relationship with Latin America and how BRA is affecting this relationship. So to put it, BRI was launched in 2013, so it's been around a long time. Series of speeches by then new Chinese leader Xi Jinping. It was originally called in English the Silk Road Economic Belt and 21st Century Maritime Silk Road, or kind of the English is often referred to as the Silk Road or something like that. Later, it was shortened to Belt and Road Initiative. Silk Road seemed a little troubling association. But the bigger picture idea for China was there's a program of way for China to use its resources to expand economic cooperation with places that it already has a lot of trading with, like Europe, but also throughout the world by supporting various forms of infrastructure development to enable economic growth and trade. Sort of like some of you familiar with the U.S. Export-Import Bank, but like on steroids, like if it was like 1,000 times bigger than it actually was when it was in project. So state-supported development projects around the world. And just to give you some perspective, There are an estimated 3,100 BRI projects that have been started since 2013, worth an estimated, and this is just a guess, at least $1 trillion. At least 123 countries around the world have agreed in some way to participate in a BRI project. Keep in mind, this is not an aid program. Like, China's not handing out money. It's a Chinese government-led program to facilitate mostly infrastructure projects, roads, bridges, power plants, ports, financed with mostly cheap state-backed Chinese government loans or Chinese bank loans. And the idea from the Chinese perspective is to support the continuing growth of Chinese state companies that have kind of run out of infrastructure projects at home in China to do, and to expand their footprint, give them more work around the world. And there's a lot of infrastructure needs to be built around the world. And also, this is the part that we might want to talk about. It deepens China's political and economic influence in places that it might not otherwise have great influence. Think about 123 countries around the world. And so just to, the U.S. originally did not have any really, was just kind of like, oh, this is great. This is just a project. But in starting in 2017, the U.S. government began to become more openly concerned and critical of the BRI as a mechanism for spreading Chinese influence. And the goal of the conversation today, I think, I would like us to try to explore in concrete terms, what exactly is the issue? Is there a problem with BRI? What should be the concern be about this sort of BRI program in places like Latin America? So, for instance, Panama has a BRI project. Does that matter? Should we care about Panama's relationship with China and the BRI? So, what I want to do then is just turn this open to our panel. And I'll begin just to set the table also, just because not all of us are up on U.S. Latin American relations. So I asked Dr. Ellis to give us maybe 5 good minutes on the overview of what are some of the big issues in U.S. Latin American relations right now. Before you dive into, I'll talk to everyone else about, BRI in Latin America in particular. So Dr. Ellis, if you could give us a quick overview. Thank you so much.
Julian, thank you very much. And also thanks to the Federalist Society for the opportunity to be part of this panel today. The usual disclaimer, although I am employed by the U.S. Army and previously by the State Department, none of what I'm going to share today necessarily represents the views of the U.S. government. So a little bit of setting the scene for the U.S. relationship with Latin America. First, it's important to recognize that independent of the political to and fro, just the bonds that continue to unite the U.S. in the region, I like to refer to as bonds of family, shared values in commerce. So, for example, the Census Bureau estimates that there are about 60.5 million people with family origins in the region as of 2019. U.S. trade with the region was about $703.2 billion in 2020. That compares, for example, with about $312 billion of Latin American trade with China. So for a Latin America perspective, the U.S. In general tends to be somewhat bigger. And also from a U.S. perspective, U.S.-China trade was only about $560 billion. And so in many ways, at least in abject overall terms, the U.S.-Latin America commercial relationship is extremely important. Now, obviously, there is a great deal of baggage as taught often in Latin American schools, remembering various occasions of real or imputed U.S. intervention in the politics of the region, particularly over the past century. But on the other hand, the United States is oftentimes seen in positive ways at the individual level in Latin America. The perception of the United States as a place where things work, the recollections of U.S. contributions, whether through USAID or others. Many countries in the region have, for example, what we call Barrio Kennedys, places that were recipients of U.S. Aid and support. And those things are remembered at least at the personal level. Obviously, at the same time, there's oftentimes a tension that the U.S. can be seen as overbearing, really in two different ways. On the one hand, its insistency on democracy procedures, rule of law, transparency, et cetera, and oftentimes its insistency on corruption and certain anti-corruption and certain policies. There was both an upside and downside to engagement in the region under President Trump's administration. On the one hand, I think there was there's in many countries a sense of appreciation and respect for the relative hands-off approach to their internal policies. And at the same time, there was a certain amount of frustration with what was sometimes at least perceived in the region as a transactional style in America's first style. And one of the ongoing themes in the region, of course, is this question of neglect, whether real or perceived. And this, of course, came around again with respect to the COVID-19 vaccines, which initially China actually had delivered more vaccines to the region than the United States, either directly or through the COVAX facility. However, that is actually ebbing now. You have about 580 million doses committed to the region, of which about 40 million have already arrived. And so, oftentimes neglect is a relative perception. Now, moving towards current events, there are clearly ideological difficulties. Perhaps now more than any other time in the previous perhaps century, the region is moving towards a leftist populist mood. You can see this with the consolidation of, frankly, authoritarian, often criminal regimes in Venezuela and in Cuba. You can see it with the increasing turn to the left with the Peronist regime in Argentina, with the return of the MAS in Bolivia, the former party of Evo Morales, with the victory of Pedro Castillo in Peru and in his Peru Libre party. The prospects, something that my colleague Eric Bremen, I'm sure is following quite closely, of the victory of a possible upcoming victory in Honduras's November election of Xiomara Castro with a new united grouping of leftist parties there. The prospect, frankly, of a turn to the left in Chile with Gabriel Boric in those elections also coming up very soon. And even as we look towards 2022, even a longtime conservative, close to the U.S. Partner, Colombia, the prospect, again, that Gustavo Petro on the left could win there, and that the Workers' Party of Ignacio Lula da Silva in Brazil could come back. And that has not just implications about individual relations with the United States, but also in terms of multilateral bodies such as the Organization of American States or bodies that promote more conservative rule of law orientations such as PRO-SUR in the region versus others of a different bent such as CELAC. Now, obviously, we're here today to talk about China, so it's important to recognize that the advance of China in recent years has caused a discomfort in Latin America. Arguably, some of the places in which, at least in terms of military and technology, they've made the most progress has been with populist regimes such as formerly in Ecuador with Rafael Correa, in obviously in Venezuela, in Bolivia, in Argentina. However, they've also made significant with research with resources and infrastructure projects in the Caribbean, and frankly, even of partners of all ideological stripes across other parts of the region, such as, for example, conservative Sebastián Piñera's Chile, Brazil, even under Jair Bolsonaro, and even close to the U.S. partners, such as the Luis Abinader regime in the Dominican Republic, who basically overrode a previous promise not too long ago to accept the Chinese company Huawei in its telecommunications infrastructure. Obviously, with the incoming administration of President Biden, there's been some things have changed, some things have stayed the same. There's been a surprising amount of continuity on things like Cuba and Venezuela. However, also some would argue a surprising amount of frustration with a lack of more progress against those authoritarian regimes. On the other hand, there's been a lot of focus on immigration, a lot of focus on Mexico, especially with the recent U.S.-Mexico security summit that was just held. A lot of very good sounding words, although questionable the degree to which the new proposal will reverse some of the difficulties in bilateral cooperation we've seen there with AMLO, and whether it'll be enough money in a program enough to overcome some of the shortcomings of the previous efforts under Merida. And then finally, worth it to point out that there's been a new tone of the new administration, not only more multilateral towards the region, but bringing new focus on things like anti-corruption, new focus on climate issues, new focus in places like Guatemala on working with particularly vulnerable or neglected groups in the region. So that has elicited both positive and negative responses, probably from a different group of people than who were pleased with U.S. policy under the Trump administration. But so it's an evolving relationship, a complex relationship. It's like a long marriage. But certainly a key to that across the region has been the advance of China and how that impacts the U.S. since we are so intimately connected with the region.
Thank you so much, Evan. That was a very good, at least for me, a very informative overview of some of the things I haven't really kept track of. Before I move, I want to then dive into some of the specifics of BRI in particular and how that might be impacting some of the countries in the region. But before I do that, I wanted to let Ryan or Eric give them a chance if they want to add anything about big issues that we should also think about with respect to U.S. Latin America that you want to jump in on, or if not, go ahead, Ryan.
Sure. I just thank you, Professor Ku, and my fellow panelists, as well as the Federalist Society and Karen and Guy for the organization of this event. It's great to be here with you all today. I think Evan went through very brilliantly a lot of where we are in the current moment, what's the big sort of macro regional landscape in Latin America. I just want to focus on just a few things that I would add to his overview. One is what I think has been ailing U.S. Latin America policy for a number of administrations now across parties, which is a sort of lack of strategic vision. You know, what is the positive agenda for the U.S. In Latin America? And I think it's not out of any sort of spite for the region, or it's just the fact is that the region, unfortunately, does not occupy the role that we all know that it has in terms of the United States security, prosperity, migration, domestic politics, et cetera. Just it plays an outsized role in all of those things, and for whatever reason, fails to receive the requisite amount of attention in U.S. foreign policy. And as a result, there's been a lack of strategic vision, I think, in the last few administrations for what is that positive agenda with the region. Meanwhile, China and other extra hemispheric actors have been enacting some sort of vision, not exactly a positive vision, in my opinion, but they've been enacting a vision in light of our, I would characterize it as relative absence. The other thing is, as I mentioned, the entrance of extra hemispheric actors in the last decade or so. So it's not just China. I realize we'll focus our comments today on China, but I just want to make a brief mention of the fact that there are other powers at play here as well, doing similar things in some aspects as what China is doing. So we're talking about the Russians and a certain amount of influence that Russia might have in various countries in the region, particularly those authoritarian populist ones that Dr. Ellis mentioned, Nicaragua, Venezuela, a little bit in Cuba. We're talking about Iran and a growing influence for Turkey in certain parts of the region. And so it's just, I think, important to keep in the back of our minds as we have a conversation today that it's not just China, even though we're going to focus our comments on China. And another thing that I think has ailed U.S. Latin American relations, and something that I want to add to Dr. Ellis's comments, is the breakdown in democratic values throughout the region that we've seen in the last couple of years, and the rise of what I would call elected autocrats in various countries, specifically because those have been ideal platforms for China to come in and exercise a greater amount of influence. And so it's not just Venezuela and Nicaragua. We're seeing a burgeoning amount of influence in El Salvador, and that's been a particularly confounding place. We've seen a burgeoning amount of influence in Bolivia. Argentina was mentioned. We'll no doubt talk about BRI and Argentina and China's presence there. But I just want to point out that the breakdown in democratic values and in the desire for democracy, even we've seen in poll after poll in the region a sort of democratic fatigue, a desire for possible experimentation with other political systems. I don't think it's quite at the point where we're worried about open calls for authoritarian political systems necessarily, but I think it's important in the context of China's engagement in the region to keep in the back of our minds that support for democracy in the region has been sliding in the past few years. And that also explains some of what China is up to in the region and some of the threats and dangers we'll talk about later, I'm sure.
Thank you so much. That's really helpful and also dark and depressing. Eric, did you want to add something? I think you wanted to add something quickly to this as well. Thank you so much.
Sure. Well, thank you. And likewise, pleasure to be here. Thank you to fellow panelists and the organizers. I would highlight one thing that was just mentioned. The issue of immigration is very much a uniquely Latin American situation, or at least predominantly Latin American situation nowadays. You know, immigration from all over the world in the U.S. has always been an issue, but now more than ever, it's both a humanitarian crisis, the national security concern, an economic drag to one extent or another. But as I think we're going to explore a bit further, it can also be the underpinnings of an opportunity of how this strategic positive agenda might create a space in Latin America that would not otherwise be possible to the U.S. elsewhere in the world. Another big theme I think that I see in the region, which very much relates to BRI, is how there is a shift in the tools that other world powers are using, such as to drive influence. So, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago, Cold War, et cetera, the tools used would have been much more outright political, to some extent military, you know, in nature. Right now, they come cloaked in economic wrapping as well as technological investments. And so the tools themselves are quite different. And I think that that lends itself to the fact that even though BRI has been a very significant strategy in the region, it's only until recently that it's really bubbled up as something of more concern, because it comes through tools that don't seem as dangerous, if you will, as outright political or outright military investments. So I'll leave it at that for now, because I think that tails in nicely to BRI and out of the region.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I think that's one big theme overall to think about for all the folks who don't follow this as closely, is that I follow US-China a lot, and it's, you know, right now we're all talking about Taiwan and all the different possible military deployments, which is important, but there's a long game going on here. And it's a much more sophisticated, complicated than simply who's got more aircraft carriers. So let me shift gears and then turn to the meat of our discussion here. So let's talk about specifics of how BRI is impacting Latin America. I know Latin America is a gigantic place with like zillions of countries, so it's a little kind of crazy to talk about it as one place. But maybe talk some examples of how BRI has had an impact on Latin America, maybe which countries have had the largest impact or largest BRI projects. So maybe we'll start with Dr. Berg to start with this on this one, and then with Ryan, and then we'll hear other folks and jump in afterwards. But Ryan, do you want to start us off here? Or?
Sure. I'm happy to give an overview of the BRI landscape in Latin America. China was relatively late to arrive in Latin America with BRI. 2017, we saw the first country, Panama, sign on to BRI. But since then, what has struck us, our Latin American analysts, is actually just how quickly BRI has expanded throughout the region. The region has 34 countries other than the United States, and 19 have signed on to BRI, if I'm not mistaken, with more expected in the future. One thing I often tell people as well is in Latin America, it does matter to an extent who's in BRI and who doesn't, but China has such a large trading port, partnership with quite a few countries that a country like Brazil, for example, is not in the BRI, but that doesn't mean that it's not the recipient of similar style loans, of similar style engagement and relationship. And so we have to bear that in mind as well, that BRI matters, of course, but there are other countries with whom China is engaging and might not be in BRI, but in similar manners to which it's engaging countries in BRI. And another thing that struck us, I think, as an alarming factor is just how quickly the economic and development relationship that's fostered by participation in BRI has gained other points of strategic depth in certain countries. And so it's moved well beyond just the simple building of infrastructure to the construction, for example, of so-called safe city initiatives, the export of pretty critical surveillance technology that many of us would consider quite frightening if we knew the full extent of what it was monitoring and what it was capable of. And there's a real market for that kind of strategic relationship in Latin America with China, if you consider that the region itself is only about 8% of the world's population and yet represents about 33% of the world's homicides. So perpetual insecurity and security politics in Latin America has given the conditions to a situation where there's a market for that kind of technology. And that has followed on, in many cases, engagement through BRI mechanisms and through infrastructure development and so forth to become more strategic in that sense. And so the other thing that I think we've seen before I allow other panelists to chime in here is that in many cases, the diplomatic recognition of Taiwan has been at stake in countries engaging with China on BRI terms. And so it was a precondition of Panama, the first country to sign on to BRI. To be able to sign on to BRI, it had to move away from Taiwan. And that's always sort of at the forefront of Chinese engagement with a lot of countries through BRI in the region. If I'm not mistaken, 7 of Taiwan's 15 diplomatic allies are located in the region. And so there's a big upside for China there in terms of engaging through BRI, and that's pulling diplomatic allies away from Taiwan. So I believe it's 7 of 15, but please correct me, Evan or Eric, if I'm mistaken. But those are three, as I paint the landscape of BRI in Latin America, those are three areas that I think are quite concerning and areas for future analysis and to pay attention to.
Thanks so much. That's a great overview. And that's an interesting angle that there's a market for Chinese surveillance and authoritarian mechanisms in Latin America, which I guess makes sense to me, but I never really thought of it that way before. Maybe let's start with Dr. Ellis. You have any sort of thoughts on some specific ways BRI is impacting from your perspective, impacting LATAM and from your perspective?
Sure. No, thanks, Julian. And let me try to add to Ryan's very good overview here. So first of all, the interesting thing, so since Panama came on, a total of 19 countries in Latin America have officially joined BRI, although it's not always apparent what that commitment actually means, other than some perception that doing so allows one to plug in more deeply and receive presumed prioritization within the Chinese money train. It's expected that at the upcoming expected state visit with Argentina and China, either early next year, that Argentina is expected to be number 20 in Latin America. In terms of the number of overall projects, and because projects in Latin America, infrastructure projects are not officially signed to BRI, I'm going to talk about infrastructure projects in general across the range of countries. Probably the most authoritative database on this is actually put out by a good friend and colleague of mine, Enrique Dulce-Peters, at UNAM in Sichimex in Mexico City. They estimate that from about 2000 through present, there have been a total of about 140 different projects, infrastructure projects by China in Latin America, totaling about $94 billion. Now, also, it's important to remember that there are other aspects of this besides just the projects. We can also talk about China's strategic partnerships in the region, membership in the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank, of which you have 5 Latin American members and 3 prospective members. But in general, when we talk about the actual projects, we can really, and again, as Ryan so well pointed out, it's multidimensional. It is construction of roads, but it's also rail. It's port construction and expansion, but it's also things like electricity generation and transmission and distribution. It's also telecommunications infrastructure. It's also banking and e-commerce infrastructure. So when we begin to put those things together, including this new term that the Chinese have coined and applied in Latin America, the digital Silk Road, you come up with some interesting insights. Number one is that it is true that very few of the big ticket items that the Chinese government or its companies have announced in Latin America have actually gone forward. So if we talk about, for example, the Twin Ocean Railway that was going to be a $10 billion project connecting the Atlantic and Brazil to the Pacific in Peru, carefully avoiding Bolivia, that didn't go forward, nor did the famous Nicaragua Canal of entrepreneur Wang Jing, nor did the Trans-Columbia Canal, nor did a series of other dry canal projects. What's interesting, though, is when you really look in the details the number of projects that I talk about, that little projects have quietly gone forward. Even today, for example, it's actually one of China's biggest infrastructure companies, that CCCC, that is involved in Andres Manuel López Obrador's Tren Maya project. Of course, we mentioned the Belgrano Cargas rail system, really, which connects Argentina across the country and with its neighbors. So already about $5 billion worth of work has been done by Chinese companies on that in the past decade, and they just signed up for about $5 billion in new work for the further modernization of that. There are countless highways worked by about five different major Chinese companies, for example, in Bolivia under the Evo Morales regime, and even in smaller places like Jamaica, about a $1 billion worth of different project fundings, first under the JDIP and then under the MDIP, just in Jamaica itself. But again, it's important not to think about just the building of highways. So, for example, when we think about ports, it is true that you find the formerly Hong Kong-based Hutchison Whampoa, with actually a total of six ports operations in Mexico, three in the Bahamas, one in Buenos Aires, Argentina, three in Panama. But there are also new Chinese port operations, such, for example, as the construction of a big new minerals port in Chiangkai in Peru, the subbing to DP World by China Harbor of the construction of the port of Pasorja in Ecuador, about four major port projects in Brazil, China Merchants Port in Kingston, Jamaica, the talk, of course, about the possible expansion into a port free trade zone complex, which I believe Eric will have some things to say with respect to El Salvador, even a new possible petroleum port in Berbice, Guyana, etc. But as I mentioned before, it's also electricity generation. China has done numerous projects in the hydroelectric sector. China has done numerous projects also in with respect to solar panels, many of which are often believed to be the technology often accused of being stolen from European partners previously. But for example, the two biggest PV projects in Latin America right now, the Cachari complex in Argentina and the new expanding complex near Assu in Brazil, both by Chinese. Electricity transmission. The Chinese have invested about $25 billion in Brazil in electricity transmission, state grid, China Three Gorges, SPIC. They've invested in about five total acquisitions in Chile, giving them control literally of 57% of electricity transmission. Yes, 57% of all electricity transmission distribution in Chile with the completion of the most recent CGE acquisition. Of course, Ryan importantly mentioned smart cities, things that are frightening in their implications with the possibilities of the export of authoritarianism, such as Equo 911 or BOL 110 or in others, as well as e-commerce. Although in the United States, we often think of Uber or Lyft, in Latin America, the Chinese rideshare application Didi Chuxing has about 50% of the entire rideshare market in the region. And of course, there are other Chinese e-commerce companies like Alibaba that continue to struggle as well. But finally, consequences. So obviously, number one is that because so few of the Chinese companies are bound by ties of transparency, things like that. We've seen massive corruption associated with Chinese projects in Venezuela and in Ecuador, among other places. The risk is an incubator of populism. So, you know, with, for example, in El Salvador right now, Nayib Bukele basically, bet on Chinese money and basically told the United States and its human rights agenda to go pack sand with respect to the firing of five, key persons within in the Attorney General, et cetera. The one of the risks, of course, as Brian that Ryan alluded to, is the loss of sovereignty. The risk that if you're passing your data, your government or commercial data through Huawei technology, given that Huawei is obligated under China's national security law to turn that over to the Chinese state if it asks. You have questions of loss of sovereignty, loss of secrets, as Ryan also really alluded to at Taiwan. So literally 9 of the 14 states in the world that continue to recognize Taiwan are found in Latin America. There's Paraguay, and then in Central America, you have Nicaragua, Honduras, Guatemala, and Belize, and then the rest in the Caribbean. And the issue then becomes, and we've seen how scary things are getting with PLA violations of Taiwanese airspace in the Cross Straits right now. And so the prospect of a war over Taiwan doesn't seem that far away anymore. But in that context, the fact that so many of the last partners that Taiwan has between it and international isolation are found in Latin America means that as partners flip to get those infrastructure projects, that destabilizes the situation in the Taiwan Straits more and more and more. And then finally, the question of who benefits from these resources. There is an absolutely fantastic report that was done using USAID data, taking a look at 100 loan contracts with the Chinese, taking a look at how things like the use of cross-default clauses and other things that we would consider lawfare really allows the Chinese to really lock. They say, okay, we don't care about your internal political conditions or transparency, but at the end of the day, the contracts that China uses in case after case after case fundamentally does undermine the sovereignty and frankly, the economic future of the countries that sign them. It's, they effectively are payday lenders, and expanding the question of who benefits from all these projects in Latin America and who benefits from its resources and who benefits from its markets. So those are some of the consequences, which again, for the United States being so intimately tied to this region, I think are of concern to us here in Washington.
Thank you so much. That's great. And that's also really, both are tremendous, useful sort of data points to think about. Let me just turn to Eric, who has a different perspective, a little more on the ground perspective to share with us. Some thoughts about BRI. Go ahead, Eric.
Been excellent. Most of the major things have been covered. I would simply add that what effects are not being had. So one of the things I've noticed with BRI projects on the ground is that they tend to not include as much local labor, local businesses, and of course, Western enterprises, U.S. companies and what have you. They're basically Chinese funded, Chinese executed, and with temporary import labor to carry it out. So, there isn't as big a boost in the economic activity that would otherwise be happening if it were more locally sourced. So that's something that's not happening. Also, the environmental dimension, and ESG related matters, they're not as present as U.S. backed infrastructure projects. And that has, repercussions, big repercussions in various countries more than others. I mean, we saw what happened in Panama, Jamaica, we can go on project by project, but in general, it doesn't seem to be an organizing principle for decision making on these massive infrastructure projects. And then something else that I think has been implied, and I think we all know, but it's worth mentioning very explicitly, almost 100% of these projects are funded by almost 100% of Chinese government money through state-owned enterprises or flat-out banks owned by the state. And that's quite different in a typical, U.S. Western set of foreign direct investment, where there is a healthy mix of multilateral and private, investment. And that comes with repercussions and implications, obviously, in the exercise of those Franconian loan terms that you mentioned. But more broadly, it's just a different ballgame altogether. It is the Chinese Communist Party basically lending and providing capital, not, the Chinese economy at large. Digital Silk Road has been mentioned in the context of smart/safer cities. But the implications of that technology and technological infrastructure being funded by China and Chinese companies, I don't think can be overstated. You know, the security implications and the economic implications by way of accessing secrets, data, and just without having to control, essentially leveraging that information for strategic advantages in a context where, again, you know, the Communist Party and state-owned enterprises having all that at their disposal without the same standards of due process that, you know, we're used to in the U.S., I don't think it can be overstated. It's huge. It's completely a different structure as U.S.-backed and Western value-backed financing. I'll leave it at that for now. I think, you know, so much has been covered. I will eventually we'll get down to some specifics and I think what we can do about it. But back to you. Thank you.
Thanks. Thanks so much. Can I just, there was a question that popped up. I thought I would just float in now. Just to go, something that Evan mentioned specifically, you know, it's always accused of, China's being accused of debt trap diplomacy. And I think I agree with Eric that although it's kind of complicated, you're right, the money is flowing through state-owned banks. It's ultimately the Chinese government backs those banks. But it's there is a Chinese government influence that's not present in a lot of U.S. infrastructure or West or other countries' infrastructure investments. And that gives them a different cast. But you were talking about the specific contracts, Evan, but is that across the board? Do you feel like there's debt trap diplomacy? Or, you know, and one thing I've always wondered is, you know, what's the worst that could happen if we've seen countries default on their lenders and the lenders are the ones who are kind of screwed, not the borrowers. So is there a way out for these borrowers in Latin America?
Well, Julian, this is a great and very important question. And I think so much of the use of debt trap diplomacy has been an unfortunate term because while it's partially accurate, it leads us to focus on one of the lesser important parts of what China does. In general, the overall contribution by China to a country's debt load in overall terms is, in some cases, it's a little bit worse than others, but it's generally not that great. But it's really how China acts as a loan shark, is a payday lender. It ensures that it gets paid oftentimes to the disadvantage of the country's development. So even the classic case of Hanbantot in Sri Lanka that you alluded to, even there, it wasn't so much about unsustainable debt, but that when that deal was signed, it was signed by one party and the work was actually done, even though it wasn't a viable alternative port. It was a port that would be built where their supporters were concentrated in. So the economic benefit would go to a certain party. Now, the other party came into power in Sri Lanka and says, well, we don't want to be saddled with this debt for something that benefits basically the political base of our opponents. And so the Chinese were there with their contract terms saying, hey, we've got a solution for you. Just give us the lease on the port and we'll take care of things. And so at the end of the day, it shows you how politics and personal benefit and kind of that lawfare with the loan terms comes into bear. And so when you look at especially the countries which are most vulnerable, the populist countries, so Venezuela, about $64 billion in Chinese spending just disappeared. And, you know, a lot of that was, you know, through corruption, but a lot of it was, for example, the Tinaco and Naco railroad project. The Chinese were actually paid to do work in a project that, you know, ended up basically being abandoned and didn't produce any value. Ecuador, the Coca-Cola Sinclair Dam facility, again, you know, even a relatively better oversight of the Korea government. But at the end of the day, Coca-Cola Sinclair had, you know, over 400 different defects, according to a subsequent German audit. Almost none of the dam projects for which the Chinese were paid in Ecuador beyond that. If you talk about Tuachi Peloton, if you talk about Mina San Francisco, if you talk about, any number of the other ones, either were completed later or weren't completed at all. And so the real problem is that China uses these vehicles for making sure that they get paid for the work that they do, even if that work produces absolutely no value. The only country that wasn't defaulted on by the Maduro regime was China, because they had that loans for oil deal in which basically all the line of credit never left China. It went through, it basically went the Chinese banks, and actually it was China, CNPC, who was actually working with PDVSA to pump the oil out of the ground. So, you know, unlike other populist governments who just say, well, we're not going to pay this bond, the only way for Venezuela to stop repaying China for that was actually to, you know, get in and physically stop the Chinese from pumping the oil out of the ground in Venezuela. So the problem that I see again and again when we talk about debt trap diplomacy is the real problem is that the less transparent you are, the less rule of law that you have, the more you're at risk, basically, that all of these things, the win-win is it goes to China's benefit with China's influence working through local elites, working through weak institutions. And at the end of the day, you know, Latin America is the one that's prejudiced, that is hurt, like it has been, you know, hurt by other, you know, interactions throughout its history.
Let me just, that
if I can just add to this, do you mind if I just add to this, Professor?
Yeah, go ahead.
So Evan mentioned, I think, a really important report in his previous response. And I think he was referring to the most recent report out of Aid Data, which is a research lab at William & Mary, a very solid research lab that's engaged in excellent research, in my opinion, on BRI. And their most recent report found that not only is opacity an intentional policy of Chinese BRI, but also that after observing and delving into more than 100 contracts, if I'm not mistaken, that countries are $385 billion more indebted than what is publicly reported. And so the level of indebtedness has been intentionally hidden as I think a way of protecting against buyer's remorse, spreading further than it potentially has. And the other thing that I would say is when it comes to debt trap diplomacy, we haven't seen Chinese engagement through BRI for enough years in Latin America, given that I mentioned in my sort of overview, 2017 is the first moment where we see a country in the region sign on to BRI. We haven't seen enough of that engagement to the point where we would see the Chinese actually taking over infrastructure projects in the same way that they have in Sri Lanka. Evan mentioned Sri Lanka as an example. And so far, what we've seen is just an extension of further credit lines or the acceptance of goods in kind like Venezuelan crude as a form of repayment. But we could in future. And I don't think it's out of the realm of possibility that we could see Sri Lankan style takeovers of critical infrastructure in Latin America if the Chinese decided not to either extend further lines of credit or extend payment timelines to countries that fall into arrears.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Eric, go ahead.
Just simply invite the attendees to do a thought experiment. When countries in Latin America have become too indebted, where it was obvious that they could not pay back, the World Bank, and largely influenced and led by the U.S., engaged in a series of debt forgiveness programs. You know, not with zero strings attached, despite that it was so reported in some cases. But those conditions, you know, would have been and were relatively aligned with principles of good governance that we would associate with. I would simply invite the audience to consider, A, would China ever engage in debt forgiveness programs? And then if they were to do so, in exchange for what set of conditions? You know, yes, takeover of critical infrastructure has already happened, but that to some extent is the lesser of the potential evils, because in the end, it's just physical infrastructure, as strategic as it may be. But how could those conditions help shift governance institutions, principles of law and order, you know, shift away from or towards democracy, free markets? So it is very significant. It's not just about, well, the lender might end up with a defaulted loan. It is what can happen as a result of these countries becoming overburdened with debt, unable to pay, where the lender then holds the cards of influence. How will they resolve those disputes? And in the middle, of course, is a system of international world order that the U.S. has to stand behind. If it doesn't, then it erodes its own interests around the world of institutions and standards that when agreements are reached among sovereigns, they have to be honored. So it ends up putting the whole system in a catch-22, and does it does really matter a lot that they not become overly indebted.
I wanted to shift gears just quickly to, and that's really an important point. But so now that we've identified the problem, What if anything can the U.S. do? And putting on my little Trump hat for the moment, like, this is a Latin American problem. It's not America's problem. They entered into these agreements. It's their deal, not our deal, right? I think you guys have made some compelling cases, but if the U.S. were to do anything, what could it do at this point? It's not even what it should do. What could it do? I guess. Maybe we'll start with Eric, since you were just wanting to talk about that one. Go ahead.
Sure. Indeed, we've been talking mostly about the situation at hand. I would like to briefly recategorize it from this simplistic perspective, which is, in our current, as USA, state of engaging with the region and recognizing the seeming lack of a positive strategic agenda, as it was mentioned earlier by Dr. Berg, it would seem to me from the ground that the main tools that are perceived at the disposal of the US are often more sticks than carrots. They can be reduced particularly to sanctions, you know, withdrawing aid, if you will, more so than being able to directly participate, as the Chinese are doing through BRI, with more positive projects inside of an FDI agenda, you know, foreign direct investment. And that's, you know, let's say historical in nature, despite the fact that the multilaterals that are aligned to Western values in the US itself speak about private participation, the realities on the ground are often incompatible with foreign direct investment that is bound by FCPA standards and that in fact seeks a return on investment. And the reasons being is, you know, on the one hand, you have conditions on the ground, which in many countries can be corrupt or weak institutions. And at best, even if they're not corrupt right now, there are short time horizons during which investors can expect legal stability. Okay. So while the Chinese, through CCP-backed institutions, are able to have a more positive set of tools of investing, the U.S. is kind of left in a defensive position of, you know, threatening to withdraw aid and not really able to promote responsible ESG-funded investments. So what can we do about it? You know, in an ideal scenario, you would help these nations improve at the root cause of their issues circumstances of good governance. That would be fantastic. And I think those are efforts that are ongoing, but they have relatively little impact at a national level in short periods of time, especially in the meantime, as you have, you know, China and other world powers not really caring about those standards and seemingly getting ahead of the curve. And, you know, I don't care about your environmental policy or labor laws or corrupt practices. Here's $1 billion and don't worry about the payment. We'll figure it out later. You know, you can't compete against that unless you have mechanisms by which to alter conditions on the ground in a timely fashion, such that they are aligned to principles and values of good governance, property rights, human rights, environmental standards, etc. And what we see on the ground with Honduras as a pioneer in the region is that the best tool available to any of these countries are special economic zones, but not special economic zones in a very traditional sense, though they have largely worked around the world. And China, in a way, is a prime example. You know, there are over 5,400 special economic zones in the world. Less than 10% of them are in Latin America, and they are a bit of a late bloomer into the mix. But by and large, most of the foreign direct investment that has come into Central American countries have come into through special economic zones. And why? Because they provide a tool by which to create conditions on the ground sooner and with greater impact than if you just sit back and wait for the whole country to reform. Okay, that's messy, and especially with relatively, you know, short periods of time during which administrations are in power, they can be ephemeral. Special economic zones of the new form that are emerging, which seek to not just create better rules today, but actually a decentralized administrative structure so that you are creating public institutions that guarantee good governance, and you wrap that around longer than, say, 4-year, you know, terms, legal stability agreements. In the case of Honduras, they extend 50 years, but in other countries, they can be 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. In any case, longer than what you as an investor need to consider what happens when the next party gets in power with a radically different agenda and can, through Congress, completely eliminate the laws upon which you invested. So special economic zones of the new type that are emerging, with Honduras as a pioneer, present that vehicle by which you break the cycle. You know, U.S.-backed capital can indeed enter into these countries with conditions of good governance that can be achieved in collaboration with national governments that honor their sovereignty, that respect property rights, and that once you achieve those better conditions, are wrapped around a longer-term horizon of legal stability. And for the region, more so than anywhere else in the world, all these challenges that we were discussing earlier, but immigration being, for me, at the top of the list, and what's been happening with, you know, Chinese manufacturing, and COVID really highlighted the threat of having too much concentration in the manufacturing sector over there, we on the ground see a great opportunity for, you know, nearshoring, relocation of a lot of that manufacturing capability onto especially the Northern Triangle of Central America, but it applies for the whole region in the context of true rule of law, ESG, you know, special economic zones that on top of countering China's influence, help deal with this, you know, humanitarian crisis seen, you know, at our border through illegal or irregular immigration. So, you know, on the ground, we are huge proponents of special economic zones properly designed and backed by U.S. government and Western values as the right tool by which to cause reform, bring foreign direct investment, and effectively counter, you know, Chinese influence in the region. With one last point, for these special economic zones to not become basically vehicles of not just Chinese influence, but any other nation state influence, there has to be, and in some countries there are, standards that they do not apply where the principal on the other side is basically a state actor. Okay? They are privately funded, co-managed, like public-private partnerships, where the public side is the nation state, the sovereign in the region, and a counterpart is indeed a private enterprise investing for profit wrapped around a long-term stability agreement in a good governance environment, as opposed to, you know, a public-to-public partnership where the counterpart is a misaligned, perhaps nefarious, state actor or state-backed, you know, organization. I'll leave it at that, but happy to answer questions.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, I think I didn't manage our time. We might be a little tight on time, but let me open the floor to start with, Ryan and then Evan to give sort of other thoughts on what the U.S., short thoughts maybe, unfortunately, at this point, what the U.S. might do. Maybe, Ryan, some quick thoughts on some additional things the U.S. might do.
Yeah, no, Eric gave a great summary of some of the potential benefits of special economic zones and more generally just what needs to happen with governance reform and private property rights and the conditions for greater foreign direct investment in some places in the region. I think what we've seen out of the Biden administration so far is a nascent discussion of rivaling the BRI in some sort of way. With a recent trip of Deputy National Security Advisor Dalip Singh to the region, to three or four critical countries in the region to talk about economic concerns and how the U.S. might push back on BRI in certain ways. I remain skeptical that we're actually going to offer something that is enticing to many countries in the region, and I remain in sort of position of show me the money. Because I just don't think it's necessarily there. I think one thing, and this kind of dovetails with what I mentioned about the positive agenda in my opening remarks, is we've been very clear with much of Latin America on our thoughts about China and about their relationship with China. And we've said no a lot, and we've also highlighted the dangers a lot. But what we haven't necessarily done is display that we have a super sophisticated understanding of what an economic decoupling from China would actually entail for much of Latin America, nor have we really demonstrated much of an appreciation for some of those costs would entail, nor have we really put in place what I would consider to be the conditions for a potential alternative. And so we're stuck in this space where we're saying no, but we're not facilitating the resources for some kind of alternative that we would find to be better. The other thing that I would say is we haven't really thought very much about the 3 to 5 critical industries where we really want to push hard to compete with China versus the ones where we see less of a strategic threat, because it's just too big of an ask to say to Latin America, you need to decouple economically from China. It's just not going to be possible. It's not going to be taken seriously by the region. And so we need to find those 3 to 5 areas where we really want to push hard and we really want to make the resources available to put in place the conditions for the alternative. Otherwise, we're really not going to going to get anywhere. And I would call that, and I've characterized it in a couple of reports before, as a policy of strategic denial. Denying China extreme influence in certain sectors that we deem to be critical after further study and further analysis, and then moving to put the resources in place to make the alternatives possible. But as of right now, I fear that we're just too busy saying no and pointing out some of the dangers of engagement, but it's falling on deaf ears because those alternatives aren't being marshaled.
Thanks. I think we're still okay with a little bit. We'll go over our time a little bit. So I'll turn this over to Eva. I'll just say one note on me. We should never try to out-China China. America will never be a better China than China is. That's always a lesson to keep in mind. Go ahead, Evan, for thoughts on what the U.S. might do here.
Thanks, Julian. And both Eric and Ryan have made some excellent points here, and I concur with both. I just wanted to start out by highlighting a few things I think are particularly important from what they said, and then add a few thoughts of my own. Number one, I think Eric did a great job of really highlighting some of the difficulties with programs like Development Finance Corporation, which I think is a great idea in principle, channeling private sector investment. But if strategically you don't have the tools in place after place to be able to actually have bookable, investments that real private sector investments actually want to invest because they don't have the judicial security, don't have the transparency, they don't have the other conditions, then it becomes very hard to actually put enough money into, basically compete against the China's kind of loan shark diplomacy, making sure that they always get paid. And I think DFC has continued to wrestle with that. And frankly, I become increasingly concerned when I see even more conditions being lumped onto DFC, with respect to, it has to be green, it has to be super anti-corrupt, et cetera, et cetera. I think we're actually shooting ourselves in the foot. The other thing I think Eric points out, and I thoroughly concur with the potential power of SEZs under the right conditions. It's interesting, actually, that I think the second point Eric made is very important as well, which is we need to push back against the effort of doing, real or effectively Chinese-only SEZs. They tried to do it in Costa Rica when Costa Rica was in problem. They tried to do it in Trinidad and Tobago. They're proposing doing it right now with a build-out of the port of La Union in El Salvador. And the bottom line, what China likes to do is basically create a space for government-to-government deals in which Chinese companies have latitude of not only not paying taxes, but special dispensation with hiring Chinese labor and how they treat that Chinese labor and things like that. It actually augments their competitive advantages and decreases transparency. And so SEZs, I think, are a powerful tool, but we have to recognize that it also can be a risk when used in the wrong way in the wrong hands. But in general, and I thoroughly also agree with what Ryan said about the difficulty, it's counterproductive to just say no, no, no. And part of the problem, I think, is we can't try. It's a strategic loser to tell our counterparts don't do business with China. I think number one, we have to focus on transparency and use our levers, Treasury, OFAC, our economic influence, other things, vehicles like USMCA, CAFTA, DR, to use our economic and other levers to insist on transparency of interactions with all players, to insist on rule of law and things like open competitive public procurements. By the way, to be there and help our partners to strengthen strengthened their capacity in things like technically competent evaluations of those complex bids, planning up front. I mean, one of the messes in Panama was the fact that you had then President Juan Carlos Varela became enamored with Chinese fast trains and was ready to commit $4 billion of the Panamanian people's money on something that was just commercially completely unviable. And oh, by the way, was nowhere to be found in the Panama 2030 long-run Panama plan. So if you're spending billions of dollars in the people's money without having a plan of how it will add value added for your country, you're probably going to get spend a lot of money without value added for your country. And oh, by the way, also, as has been alluded to on the back end, pressing for enforcement of laws, whether labor or transparency, you're not going to stop all Chinese projects, but you will in many ways force the Chinese into a more level playing field in a way that makes that engagement less threatening. And then I think two final things. Number one is there are certain areas that are so threatening to a country's sovereignty. And, I put things like smart cities with Huawei and HikiVision cameras and things like that. 4G and 5G, again, with significant reliance on Huawei equipment, where, the ability to even do an investment in the country because you can't protect your own IP. You can't, governments can't protect their freedom of decision because you can compromise the vice minister's, personal life, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think, but when we do those things, we have to work with like-minded other allies, whether it's, Nokia or Ericsson or others, to help provide commercially viable alternatives if we say, don't go with Huawei. And then finally, and I'm glad what we're doing here, and I'm very happy with studies that, support what Ryan said about that excellent study. Thoroughly encourage everyone to take a look at, the 100 Chinese debt projects with USAID, data, excellent. And an example of the type of thing that we need to be doing more of, which is more data-based analysis of what do the Chinese actually do? What is good? What's bad? How does that compare with others? So that when we engage, either politically or otherwise, we're not just saying, China's bad, don't do business with the China. But we have empirical evidence of why certain types of things do not lead to an outcome that is not just in our own best interest, but do lead to outcomes that are not in the self-interest of our partners. And so we need more data-driven things like that. And I think we need to invest more time and in energy in doing so. But this is a very, very hard problem. But I think forums like this and data efforts like that move us at least a little bit in the right direction and absolutely need a new strategic concept for how we do this.
Well, thanks so much. I think we've blown through our time limit. So I don't. I'm sorry that we weren't able to get to folks' questions. I know some folks have to sign off anyways. So they only allocated this time. So I think maybe that's a great way for us to end this, to take this conversation. What I've learned a lot, anyways, and this tremendous amount. I think it's such a complicated problem to deal with. I really appreciate the different angles that everyone's provided here. So thanks so much. I hope we can continue to discuss this issue in different ways down the road. I really learned a lot, and I hope our audience has done so as well. I will go ahead and sign off if that's okay. And thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thanks, Tom.
Thank you to everyone. Thanks. Appreciate it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks. Okay. Well, I guess, go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was going to give the, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our experts for the benefit of their valuable time and expertise today. And I want to thank our audience for joining and participating. We also welcome listener feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. As always, keep an eye on our website and your emails for announcements about upcoming teleforum calls and virtual events. Thank you all for joining us today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.